This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. After 25 years of making movies and television, our guest Paul Weiland has made a film based on a comically tragic story from his childhood, how his 1966 bar mitzvah in London was ruined by the improbable coincidence of England winning its only World Cup title in London on that very day. The story, recounted in Weiland's film 66, is richer than that. Weiland's father suffered from obsessive and compulsive disorder, and coping with his illness shaped the family's interactions. Weiland felt overlooked by his family and underappreciated at school. He hoped his bar mitzvah would change all that, at least for a day. In this scene from 66, Weiland's character Bernie, played by Greg Sulkin, hears from his rabbi, played by Richard Katz, what a bar mitzvah can be.
It is an epic two-day festival at which you are the absolute center of attention.
At my bar mitzvah, God would switch on a spotlight, and for the first time, everyone would really see me. From that moment on, I became the greatest party organizer in history. I spent every minute preparing for the day and burning Rubens with walk on water.
Everybody you know will be invited, everyone will come, there will be presents everywhere. And you stand there, on that day, a son of the commandments, a bar mitzvah.
My bar mitzvah was going to make my brother Alvy's look like a children's tea party. Mine was going to be the Gone with the Winds of bar mitzvahs. It was going to be the Cassius Clare bar mitzvahs. The Jesus Christ of bar mitzvahs. In 9 months' time, I was going to be a legend.
Well, Paul Weiland, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, this film, 66, is based on the story of your own bar mitzvah. You've been making movies and television shows for a long time. Why do this story at this point in your career?
Basically, this goes back to my 50th birthday party, and I needed to make a speech, and I'd been quite nervous about it because I'm not much of a public speaker. You know, I'm much better when I'm telling other people what to do and what to say. And I just thought, well, what am I going to say? And it occurred to me that the last important party I had, no one showed up to, and it happened to be my bar mitzvah. And as I started to write the speech, I suddenly began to realize that I was probably onto something here. And the speech went down so well that there was some producers from Working Title at the party, and a guy called Tim Bevan came up to me and said, look, if you ever want to make this as a film, I'll do it. And it was like, it's amazing. You know, because I didn't really mean it to be a pitch, but it ended up being that.
Now, in the film, we're introduced at the very beginning to the central character, Bernie Rubens, who was, you know, the guy who I guess is, you know, the equivalent to you. And
yes.
He's a kid who wears glasses. He is picked dead last for the soccer team after the kid who had polio and had a brace on his knee. Kind of easily overlooked, kind of a nerd. Was that you?
Yeah, that's exactly me, really. Not, as I said, not really excelling at anything. But, you know, and that was the thing that, you know, they used to pick up. And when I made the movie, I decided that what I was going to do was go back and stand up against that exact same wall. And what was amazing is that the drinking fountain that we used to drink from was still on that wall. The plumbing had changed slightly.
Now, when you say the wall, you mean the wall where the kids are standing up as they're being picked for soccer?
Yeah. That was actually the rejection wall that I remember. And but what was wonderful is to actually go back there and this time be slightly in control, which is kind of what the film was about. I needed to go and kind of blow some of those demons away.
So we have a kid in the movie and in your life who, you know, certainly not a standout, who has some issues. But when he hears from the rabbi what a momentous event his bar mitzvah will be, at which he will be the center of all attention and affection from those around him, he's enthralled at the idea. And in the film, we see this kid, he says he becomes an expert party planner. He is going to get into this and throw a party that will be legendary. Did you do that as well?
Yeah, that was the whole thing, that this was going to be my coming out. This was going to be the day that everyone noticed Paul Weiland. And it was important to me. It was important. And, you know, the whole thing with, you know, in the movie, Bernie goes into the garage. And basically the garage was very much part of my growing up, because basically my mother really didn't like too much mess in the house, and everything. You know, in the movies, you'll see it's kind of covered in plastic, which we used to have to sit on, and the plastic was only ever removed when visitors came.
So that's really, that is in the film, and that's because of your dad's obsession and compulsion?
No, because my mum was a bit obsessed as well. Uh-huh. And in a way, it was kind of hard for the writers on this, because we couldn't make the family just a bunch of lunatics. So we had to slightly calm my mother's role or character down. But the plastic covers were much to do with, you know, my mother preserving things. Because as I said, that when we moved to North London, everything was brand new, and that is the way she wanted to keep it. And in the end, it ended up as a bit of a godsend to me, because when we were building the home or the set at Pinewood Studios, everything on that set belonged to my mother, because it was still in almost pristine condition. So the period details were absolutely perfect, from the front doorbell to even down to the bar mitzvah cards that I received. She, you know, my mum, thankfully, never threw anything away, even the carpet that's rolled up. Because, you know, not only do we have plastic covers on everything, but we used to have carpets on top of carpets. And they were the offcuts when they were laying the carpet. So it was almost like stepping stones, that you never trod on the real carpet. You were always treading on the outcuts of the carpet when it was first put down.
So that it's...
Does that sound mad?
A little bit. Yeah, this does sound like an interesting childhood to recreate, and it sounds like you actually resurrected parts of it. You went back to the original wall and the original house.
Yeah, but that was the weird thing, because, you know, when I was standing on the set and I was standing on that same piece of carpet that I stood on when I was 5 years old, I mean, that is an amazing feeling. And the feeling when at the end of the shoot, you know, we could actually skip the carpet, it went into the bin and it was gone and it was done. That was amazing for me.
Wow. So just to be clear here, we're talking about your family so obsessed with protecting the carpet, they laid other carpets on top of it, which they would take back when company would come.
Yeah.
And that's why
the carpet survived. That's why when I went back there 40 years later, the carpet has survived for 50 years. Looked brand new.
Well, so in this odd house with the dad with the obsession and compulsion comes your bar mitzvah being planned, and you take this enormous interest in. I mean, when you said, did you like look at hotel rooms that one would and catering menus and make guest lists and table seating and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, you see, very early on, what I kind of realized was that I wasn't going to be able to really leave it to my parents. And the history of this is that my brother, who in real life is 5 years older than me, in the movie he's kind of just a couple of years older, they gave him a pretty stonking bar mitzvah at a place in Finchley, which is in North London. And it kind of aggravated my parents. Like, it was a lot of stress for them, or especially my mother at that time. And after that was over, and they didn't really get back in presents what they had paid out for the bar mitzvah.
Right.
That's a bit cruel, but that they decided when it came to my bar mitzvah that I was already, you know, going to get something a lot smaller. Quite as small as it ended up was not really on their agenda, but they had purposely planned that they were going to put, my birthday was actually on July the 11th, and they booked the bar mitzvah for July the 30th. Which was at a time when most people would be away on holiday.
So they knew most people would be away, right?
And then there would be a chance that maybe they would send a gift because they were away, but then they wouldn't have to cater for so many people. So I was kind of aware of this. So I felt that I needed to take a bit of control of the situation and see if I could, you know, up the numbers a bit and up the kind of scale of the party. So there were a lot of things going on, but obviously I came unstuck.
So there you are. Your parents are trying to make this thing a smaller event. You want to plan a blowout that will endure in time. And then at some point you realize that July 30th is the date of the final of the World Cup.
Right. Yeah, and this is just like the final straw that broke the camel's back. It's just that, again, I wasn't aware, you know, at the time. It was only in hindsight that I realized that I was getting the smaller bar mitzvah in the first place, because no one really wanted to tell me that. And then on top of this, the World Cup final is being played in England for the first time ever. And no one really is rating England's chances of going very far in the competition. But as luck would have it, they started to progress right through to the final. And I won't give away what happens in the final, but it's, you know, it's obviously in the history books, but it became the biggest sporting event ever in the history of the UK, I think.
All right, so we won't give away everything that happens in the film, but as much as you can tell us about what happened in your life, you do have this young man who's very anxious, and England does get into the World Cup finals, and it is a national obsession. Tell us what you can about your bar mitzvah when it finally arrived.
Well, you know, basically, there were, as the progression of England, as they went further in the competition, we started to get some phone calls of people beginning to pull out, especially when they made it into the final. My uncle Leonard, who basically was the chap that used to do all the cine films and all the photographs at all the family functions, suddenly pulled out as well. So there isn't one single picture of me or photograph at the bar mitzvah. I hope your audience are going to feel very sorry for me and go and see this film now. So basically it's absolutely true. And, you know, at my 50th party, when I made the speech, I invited my Uncle Leonard, and he got up and said a few words of apology all those years later, and actually admitted that he had actually gone to the final. So it is quite funny. But the heart of the movie is really, and what the movie's about, you know, obviously it's not just about the World Cup, it's about a boy who is invisible to his family and a boy whose father is taking all the attention in the home. So the mother doesn't, you know, he's the child, the father becomes the child. And, you know, basically the bar mitzvah is used as a kind of excuse to, as I said in the beginning, to absolutely get seen. It's like, hello, everyone, I'm here. Please see me. And, you know, that's, in the end, it didn't work out. But what I could do with the movie is that I was able now as a director to slightly rewrite history.
Well, you know, the kid, as you describe yourself, was, you know, somebody who had a lot of issues and no self-confidence and was sort of easily ignored. You've had a successful career in television and film. When did you realize that you had something worth being proud of?
That's an interesting one, really, because as I said, at school I didn't thrive at all, and I left school with not really a single qualification worth talking about. I mean, the only test certificate I got was a cycle proficiency test. And I think that but for some reason I had this absolute belief in myself. And, you know, to this day, you know what? I do not know where it comes from. I just told people, and I went into advertising very early on. I started off as a messenger boy, and I kind of worked my way into a position where I then became a copywriter. And I just had this ability to get people to help me. You know, people, just because I was cheeky and quite amusing, and I played the underdog quite a lot, so mm-hmm. people didn't really find me a threat, but they tended to want to become my mentor, and that's how I started to develop my career.
You know, we've been talking about all these, you know, big emotional issues that the film deals with, but this film really is very funny. And I wonder, when you were a kid and you were going through it, did it seem funny in any way at the time?
Look, again, when you're going through it, that's what your life is. You don't know that it's any different from any other child's existence. But it's only when you start, you know, visiting the friend down the road that you realise what you're kind of being brought up in is not the norm. And the way I used to deal with that and my brother is that we, you know, I have to say this and it's a bit cruel, but we used to kind of wind my dad up a bit. You know, because every night he would be in our bedroom and he would be checking that the electric heater was switched off, right? Because obviously in those days there were no central heating and it was freezing. So kind of before you went to bed, you might have an electric blanket on and the three-bar heater. And he would come in and go through this ritual probably every night, and he would turn that heater off and on probably 50 times. While my brothers were there, and then he would leave the room and he would look through the door. And, you know, obviously I touch on that in the film. And I don't do too much of it because, you know, again, I'm making a working title film and I don't want to, you know, it's not a complete drama. But it could have swung in that direction. It could have swung in that direction. But that's not my approach to life. My approach is, you know, like, let's find, okay, there's a serious voice here, but also let's try and cure it or deal with it with using humour. And my brother and I used to, and this is horrible, that he would do this, and on 50 times he would finally shut the door and it would be quiet for a minute or so, and then my brother would jump out of bed and turn the heater on, right, and then call, Dad, the heater's on. Yeah, and so the whole, but that was the only way that we could deal with it. And I suppose, in a way, that's what the film's about. I deal with that, deal with the pain via the humour, using the humour.
As you're making this film that is so personal, I wonder, were you concerned about the reactions of your family or friends?
In fact, my brother got to a point where he wouldn't actually sign the release because he was slightly worried that the family were going to end up looking pretty bad. And what happened is that when he eventually did see the film, he absolutely loved it, so it didn't become an issue. And of course, the minute she knew that Helena Bonham Carter was playing her, she was absolutely delighted and would sign anything away. So
has she seen the final cut?
Oh, yeah. She sees it, and she kind of regularly watches it. You know, she loves it, you know, and it's given her, in her little kind of group of friends, it's given her a real kind of kudos.
And
she actually appears in the film. She actually appears behind Helena in the synagogue when I'm being bar mitzvahed. And also in the end credits, I show the footage of my brother's bar mitzvah from 1961. And my mother appears in that. So she's made it to Hollywood, which is great. She's a very beautiful woman.
She looks great in those home movies. You do a wonderful thing at the end where you see the home movies of the actual real-life characters as the cast members are revealed on the screen. Your dad's no longer with us?
No, he died 10 years ago.
Any what do you think he would have thought?
Oh, God knows. He probably, I don't know, actually. He would have thought that I'm completely round the bend bonkers. In fact, when I first showed a very early test, we did a very early test screening in a place called High Wycombe, and it was so weird because I sat there and I thought, oh, my God, what have I done? This living room that I have been all my life trying to get out of, here am I putting all these people in that same living room. What have I done? And I had a moment of panic.
So did the fact that your bar mitzvah was overshadowed by the World Cup put you off of soccer, or as you say in England, football, for the rest of your life?
Well, it's a very funny story, that, because that night, as I lay in my bed and I heard the next-door neighbours celebrating and people dancing in the streets, and my kind of day had been completely ruined, I placed a curse on the English football team, and to this day they've never won again.
I think this may be a security risk for you to reveal this.
But you know what, I'm going to, now on this radio program, I'm lifting that curse. So at the next World Cup, I think we'll win.
All right, is any ceremony needed, or we'll just take your word for it that
I've just cut it. It's gone. It's gone.
Released.
It's just, Yeah, they're released. Go ahead. Go England. Go win the next World Cup, please.
Well, Paul Whelan, you have come a long way. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Paul Whelan's film 66, starring Helena Bonham Carter and Eddie Marsan, is opening in selected cities in August and September.